The NRA's annual meeting kicks off today in Dallas, how the organization raises hundreds of millions from its members and beyond.
The NRA used its membership communications, like its magazines, to foster this positive gun owner identity among its members, and that really worked. And then the NRA would appeal to that identity in order to mobilize people.
How the NRA turns identity and tragedy into political power. Also today, a dispute over ancient artifacts puts the legacy of British colonialism on display.
I think the fundamental question is, who owns it? Whose is it?
Plus, NASA's next trip to Mars launches tomorrow. Will we finally find out?
Is there life on Mars?
NASA's InSight lander is carrying a seismometer, not a biology lab. We just wanted to play that. I'm Todd Zwillick, and this is The Takeaway.
Hey, podcast people, it's Tanzina Vega. I'm going to be hosting this podcast starting next week, and I'm so excited that you're along for the ride. Remember, tell all of your friends to subscribe to this podcast now, and they'll get a daily dose of news, analysis, and views that you won't hear on every other news podcast. I mean real people, like you. If you like it, rate it and review us on iTunes, and keep letting us know what you think. I'll see you soon on The Takeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's great to have you here with us on this Friday. The National Rifle Association kicks off its annual meeting today in Dallas. 80,000 people are expected, and they're getting things going with a high-profile cast of speakers. Today, Texas Republican Senator Ted Cruz.
God bless the NRA.
Ted Cruz is up for re-election this year, and he's in a tough race against a popular Democrat. So for Ted Cruz, the NRA in Texas is much-needed friendly territory. Social media personalities Diamond and Silk are on stage today.
Drop that beat! Trump's your president!
He's your president! And the president, Donald Trump, is speaking. VP Mike Pence, too. And that speaks to the massive influence the NRA enjoys in American politics. And a lot of that comes from the organization's astounding ability to raise money.
To the Ayatollahs of Iran and every terrorist you enable, listen up.
We are done with your agenda to undermine voters' will and individual liberty in America.
You don't speak for me, and you don't think for me.
Where the people will defend this nation with their bloody, calloused, bare hands. That's what it takes.
I'm the National Rifle Association of America.
I'm the National Rifle Association of America.
I'm the National Rifle Association of America.
And I'm freedom's safest place.
So much of the National Rifle Association's fundraising doesn't have much to do with guns. It has a lot more to do with identity. But the pro-gun lobby faces some of its most intense scrutiny in its history after mass shootings at a music festival in Las Vegas, a church in Texas, and a high school in Florida. But the month after 17 people were killed at a school in Parkland, Florida, the NRA didn't lose money. They broke a 15-year fundraising record.
My name is Bill. I'm calling from Olympia, and I do contribute to the NRA. I believe the NRA is a major reason why the firearm ignorant anti-gun folks have not succeeded in taking away our right to own semi-automatic rifles that are dressed to look like assault rifles, such as the AR-15 or AK-47.
I think the money is used to support lobbyists, and I contribute in order to preserve the Second Amendment. This is David from Miami.
We want to take a look at the NRA's fundraising machine, where the money comes from, and also where it goes, including recent reports that investigators are now interested in the NRA. And the possibility that the organization funneled money from rich Russians with connections to the Kremlin to Donald Trump's presidential campaign.
I think that the NRA is pretty special in the way that it raises its money and the way it spends its money in order to influence American politics. You know, there is a direct relationship between how the NRA gains its political power and how it raises and spends its money.
That's Charlotte Hill, a political science researcher at UC Berkeley who studies campaign finance.
Here's how it works. The NRA raises almost $500 million a year from a combination of regular people, but also corporations, super PACs, and extremely wealthy donors like the Koch brothers. It then uses that money to do two things. One, it convinces gun owners that their rights and their values are under attack. And then two, it mobilizes those gun owners against any politician who supports gun control. So as a result, if you're a politician with constituents who own guns, and especially if you represent a conservative district, you're afraid to cross the NRA. That means that the NRA is effectively controlling what you do, even if they never spend any money against you directly. And that's a lot of power for one organization to have.
But what makes the NRA so special in this regard? I mean, as a political journalist myself, I get all kinds of fundraising appeals from all kinds of organizations and politicians all over the political spectrum. You just sort of follow them. It's part of your job. And a lot of them use fear and loathing and vilification of the other side. They use crisis language to get you to give money. Why is the NRA different?
I'd say it's different for two main reasons. The first is that the NRA has spent almost a century intentionally building a political identity among its members. So there's some really great research on this from this researcher named Matt Lacombe. He's a PhD candidate at Northwestern University who's studying the NRA. And what his research finds is that NRA members are especially receptive to calls to action from the NRA because they have a really strong social identity around gun ownership. What he did was Matt looked at the language used in the NRA's magazine, The American Rifleman, and he compared it to the language used by gun rights activists in letters that they wrote to newspapers. And he looked at data over 9 decades and showed that the NRA used its membership communications, like its magazines, to foster this positive gun owner identity among its members, and that really worked. And then the NRA would appeal to that identity in order to mobilize people. They would say, look, we know that you are law-abiding. We know that you are gun owners who care about the safety of your family and the safety of this country, and that's why we need you to contact your legislators and fight gun control. And it was really effective. The second piece that I think is really, really critical is that the NRA's interests are aligned with an industry's interests. So the NRA is really in the business of protecting a commercial product, which is the gun. And that means that they can build their entire revenue model around that product. They can sell magazines with articles on which guns you should buy. They have trainings on how to use your gun. They offer firearms insurance. They can sort of weather certain storms that maybe come from mass shootings and just provide these services and these advertisements and these product placements. Gun control organizations, on the other hand, are fighting against an industry. So not only do they have to fight the spending from the NRA and from gun companies, but they also don't have an obvious business model. You can't offer trainings on how not to use a gun. You're not going to publish a magazine full of articles against gun buying. That wouldn't be engaging for anyone to read. So what that means is there's an inherent advantage in our political system to being an organization that is aligned with a business industry.
Charlotte, the biggest story right now when it comes to NRA and their fundraising is the possible relationship with Russians. Now, a prominent NRA member is a man named Alexander Torshin. He's head of the Russian Central Bank. He's an NRA member, as I mentioned. And recent reporting suggests that the NRA is preparing for the possibility of an investigation into whether money from wealthy Russians like Torshin is among the $30 million that the NRA spent to help Donald Trump's campaign in 2015 and 2016. Now, that investigation hasn't happened yet. We don't know if it's true. But knowing that those questions are being raised, being an expert on how the NRA raises money, what does it have you thinking about?
Right. So the story of Russia and Donald Trump and the 2016 election is a fascinating one and a complicated one. The evidence is still coming in on whether that money was illegally funneled to Donald Trump. The FBI has just begun investigating that now. I think that this story really speaks to the importance of having greater transparency around political fundraising and political spending in this country. There are types of organizations that are able to raise money from other organizations and only have to report the name of the organization that they raised the money from. They don't have to report the names of the individuals who were contributing to the organization that they took money from. And that creates an opportunity for a whole lot of dark money in our political system. So I hope that people will hear some of the data, you know, and the evidence coming in around these potential Russian contributions through the NRA and think, you know, we need more transparency around political spending in this country.
Well, let's talk about the lack of transparency that's already in the law. I'm going to play for you Marco Rubio, senator from Florida, who was part of the debate after the tragic shooting at a high school in Parkland, Florida, at the end of February. Listen to Marco Rubio.
Guys, the influence of any group.
We're going to be here all night.
The influence of these groups comes not from money. The influence comes from the millions of people that agree with the agenda. So the millions of Americans that support the NRA and who
all
support
right.
gun rights
sorry,
groups.
Senator. Guys.
Marco Rubio shouting over the crowd at a loud town hall on CNN there. But Charlotte, Marco Rubio, if you check the records in 2016, got $9,900 in contributions for his campaign from the NRA. That's a lot, but it's not a ton in American politics. Does that tell the whole story?
It does not tell the whole story. So this is actually the reason why I started looking into the NRA's fundraising and spending. What I discovered is that Marco Rubio is right in a very narrow sense. The NRA does not spend that much money on direct campaign contributions to politicians. For example, in 2016, the NRA directly donated just over $1 million to federal candidates. So it's a lot of money, but the average House of Representatives candidate who wins their election spends about $1.5 million just themselves in a single election. Now, where the NRA does spend a lot of money, and this gets left out of the conversation so often, is on political advertising that is done independently of candidates. Since the late 1990s, the NRA has spent more than $140 million on political ads, most of them attacking candidates who support gun control, and most of that money has been spent in just the last few elections. So, for example, in 2016, the NRA spent $55 million in independent spending.
Well, Charlotte, let's end with that mass shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland. Because the NRA, after that shooting, didn't lose money. In fact, they raked in $2.4 million. It was the most money that the NRA's political arm had raised in 1 month since June of 2003. And I wonder if knowing what you know, what you found out about the NRA and how it operates in politics, if that surprises you.
It does not surprise me. The NRA does better when its members perceive their rights to be under threat or their lives to be under threat. That is often when a Democrat is in the office of the presidency or after a mass shooting has occurred, because the media and politicians start talking about gun control. And the NRA frames those conversations about gun control as conversations about stripping away the Second Amendment rights of gun owners. It's really great fodder for them to use in their marketing campaigns and in their grassroots lobbying efforts. So the general approach for the NRA is to lie low for a few days while emotions are high. And then as people start to calm down, the NRA begins pushing its members to fight for their gun rights and fight against gun control. As one example of this, a little over a week after the Parkland shooting, the NRA's top lobbyist sent out an email to NRA members, and it says that the gun control faction is out in full force, determined to use the senseless murder of the students and adults at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School as an excuse to promote their gun ban agenda. And then the email says, in all bold, please email the following members of the legislature immediately and tell them no gun control. It's emails like that and other emails, you know, that specifically call for contributions that raise the NRA millions of dollars in the wake of these tragedies.
Charlotte Hill, political science researcher at UC Berkeley, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Melanie Douglas spent 12 years driving a school bus for the DeKalb County School District in Atlanta. That is, until last week, when Melanie Douglas was fired.
I love my job because I love my kids. But we're put in unsafe situations. We're put with too many children on the bus. We weren't getting paid enough. We haven't had a raise in over 7 years. And it was time.
School bus drivers in DeKalb County, Georgia, have complained for years about working conditions and low pay. Last month, they decided on action, calling in sick for 3 days and leaving parents across the county to find other ways to get their kids to school. Nearly 400 drivers participated on that first day. That was just under half the county's school bus drivers.
All we were asking for was, number one, a pay raise. There's no way that a person can live off of the pay you're getting at DeKalb County. Also, we have a lot of older women that have been working for 30, 40 years and go to retire, and they're only going to get $110 a month. We're giving our life to this job, to the children, and we have nothing to fall back on as we age.
The sick out caused hour and a half delays in some places. In other places, buses didn't come at all. The DeKalb County School District responded quickly. Here's Stephen Green, the district superintendent, at a press conference on April 19th.
For those bus drivers who opted not to come to work today, you have willingly put our students in harm's way. Your actions will have consequences, and there will be repercussions.
Superintendent Stephen Green also cited the law here. In Georgia, he said it is illegal for any public employee to promote, encourage, or participate in any strike. At least 7 drivers have been fired so far, including Melanie Douglas, who spoke with The Takeaway yesterday.
To fire someone because they take a stand and we did not do anything violent or, you know, start any problems or anything, it went beyond what was called for.
Douglas and other bus drivers are now thinking about what to do next. Marlon Walker is an education reporter on the story for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
I've been covering this for about the whole 3 years since I've been here. Back in 2015, drivers came before the school board and talked about the overcrowded buses, bad retirement plan, low pay. Since then, pay has been increased incrementally. I think every school district around the country has dealt with cutbacks when it came to the recession, and bus drivers are just perpetually some of the worst paid employees in school districts across the country. And because it was typically seen as a part-time job, they don't really have the benefits that you would expect. I think a driver told me the other day she's been in 20 years, and when she finally retires, if she retired tomorrow, she'd get a payout of about $211 a month.
Nothing to live on, in other words.
No. But, you know, drivers make an average of about $22,000 a year, and that's if you work more than the standard 6-hour workday.
So, Marlon, the school district wound up firing 7 drivers behind this strike. Why these 7 out of several hundred that you said participated in the sick out?
Well, so far it's at least 7. That's what I'll say. The school district is sticking to the 7 number, but the bus drivers are telling me that there may be up to as many as 10 so far. I think the issue was that, according to the letter they received from the superintendent, Steve Green, it said that the district had reliable information that they had promoted or encouraged the organization.
Rabble rousers, in other words.
Pretty much.
Well, Marlon, what are parents and other members of the community saying, not only in support or opposition to the sick out itself, but after 7 or 10 or more drivers have been fired?
It's been a bit of a mixed bag. You've had people who, because of their schedules, felt inconvenienced and were frustrated with that. But then you have people who looked at the other side of the coin and said that, you know, because this is someone who's so integral to their day, they were okay with making the adjustments because they knew what the drivers were really going after. And they figured, you know, it takes a lot to take off work and to do something like this. But of course, there were some frustrated parents who, you know, regardless, just felt like the inconvenience was too much for them and that the driver should have done something else to figure out a way to get their voices heard.
Sure. And that's always part of the benefit and the risk of a strike, right? The inconvenience kind of speaks very loudly, but it can also cut against you, especially with busy parents who have kids in school. But what are parents saying about the core demands here about pay and respect for drivers?
They understand it. I think a lot of people, especially in this environment, understand that you know, you want to be paid for what you're worth. I don't think the bus drivers will ever be paid for what they're worth, because a lot of drivers and managers, you know, they know that this was meant to be a part-time job. This is typically a job that was held by a mom sort of toiling away as their child was at school, or a retiree playing out those golden years and just wanting a little bit of low maintenance income. But over the years, and with the recession and the housing crisis from 10 years ago, you found people who were taking advantage of this as an opportunity to make money, have a more flexible schedule, maybe have a second job.
Well, Marlon, we've been seeing a lot of action in education this year all around the country. Strikes in West Virginia, Arizona, Oklahoma, Colorado, planned actions in other places as well. Are we seeing echoes of that here? I mean, these aren't teachers, of course, but integral workers in the school world. Are they watching and listening strikes elsewhere and thinking that they can participate too?
I think they are. I don't think anybody said it specifically that this is something that prompted them to do this, but there was a bus driver strike in February in Seattle for some of the same things. I think a lot of them are dealing with increased healthcare costs, which if you make $20,000 a year, $20 extra a month is a big deal. So, you know, with the different movements around the country, I think they're seeing them and I think they're feeling empowered. But I think the situation here was that these drivers, after some say, you know, 8 years of conversations with the school district, felt like enough was enough. And if they were the ones to strike out, maybe some of the area districts would follow suit.
So, Marlon, what's next? Several drivers have been fired, as you said. Plans from the drivers for their next move?
It sounds like there are meetings that legislators locally have started to put together with the superintendent to ask for those jobs back. Outside of that, I've heard grumblings of a possible organized protest. I don't know anything specific about that, but I don't think they want to let this die down, especially the way my phone keeps ringing from drivers who are wanting to share information as things come up.
Marlon Walker covering striking school bus drivers in DeKalb County, education reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Marlon, thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If you like what you're hearing, give us a rating and review us on iTunes. Also, tell your friends. Share this podcast on Facebook or Twitter or wherever you want your followers to get some solid news coverage. They'll be smarter. They'll think you're a hero. It's a win-win. All right, now back to the show.
The Boston Celtics were on the court last night in the NBA playoffs. They came back from a 22-point deficit to beat the Philadelphia 76ers in Game 2 of the Eastern Conference semifinal and take a two-game lead in that series. Now, the Celtics are playing this year on the anniversary of a triumph in team history, and it all had to do with legendary Celtics player coach Bill Russell 50 years ago this week.
Havlicek drives around a triple screen, and the never-say-die Boston team wins the world's professional basketball crown, 124-109 in the final against Los Angeles.
That was 1968, the Celtics taking the NBA championship and making Bill Russell the first black coach to ever win a major professional championship. Esteban Bustillos has been reporting on the legacy of Russell's groundbreaking achievements for our partner WGBH Radio in Boston. Esteban, thanks for being here.
Hi, Todd. Thanks for having me.
You were on hand to see the Celtics beat the 76ers last night. How was it?
It was very loud. Boston is pretty excited. You know, this team is undermanned right now. So to see this level of success they're having, the city is really backing them up.
Well, Esteban, let's talk about Bill Russell and how Boston is experiencing the 50-year anniversary of the Celtics championship in 1968. What is Bill Russell's place in Boston culture?
So I think a lot of it has changed since that. You know, back in 2013, he got a statue that's right outside of City Hall, although a lot of folks here say that's really overdue. He's still revered around the city, but I think his legacy has become more appreciated over time. Back in 68, it wasn't something that people necessarily talked about. It's not even something that that Russell really acknowledged. To put this in context, specifically what was going on just around that time, you know, this was a little around 2 months after President Johnson announced he wouldn't be running for re-election. A lot of that had to do with the Vietnam War. Just under a month before Russell won this championship as the first black coach in the NBA to do it. MLK was assassinated in Memphis. So the country was going through a lot of pain and a lot of confusion and change. And much like today, sports really helped to contextualize that.
Well, here's Bill Russell talking to WGBH back in 2001.
This was going on all over the country. And the reason I guess people think of me as being unaccepting of segregation and racism, this happened to be the place I landed.
Esteban, Bill Russell did not mince words about Boston. He called it a flea market of racism. What was his experience in 1968 and during his career with racism in Boston?
You know, he lived in a suburban neighborhood of Boston, and his home was vandalized multiple times because he lived in a white neighborhood and he was black. So even though he was one of the most recognizable faces in the city, he was not accepted within his own community. And that was really the experience of many, not just black athletes, but just black people within the city. You know, just 9 years before this, in 1959, the Red Sox became the last team to integrate in Major League Baseball. 6 years after 1968, that's when Boston would just barely start the process of desegregating its public schools. So for someone like Bill Russell, his experience was really, really reflective of the experience that a lot of the city's black community had during those years, and unfortunately still has today.
Well, Esteban, Bill Russell is an integral part of this legacy 50 years after his historic win, the NBA championship in 1968. Take just a second before we go and talk about his legacy as a player, because he was incredible.
Right, so right off the bat, when you talk about who he was as a player, I mean, he won 11 NBA titles. That's a record that's still unmatched and still unprecedented. You know, a lot of folks like to talk about Michael Jordan as the greatest ever, but Jordan only has 6 rings. Russell has 11. To see that success, not only as a player, but also as a coach, to see that coming from a minority wasn't precedent at the time. And it's opened a lot of doors for black and other minority coaches and athletes today. And if you hear clips from athletes all the time referring to Russell as the GOAT, as the greatest of all time, and not only for what he did on the court, but for his ability just to be honest and outspoken off of it.
Esteban Bustillos reporting on the legacy of Bill Russell in Boston for WGBH Public Radio. Esteban, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Todd.
NASA is getting ready to send a new mission to Mars. For the first time now, looking at the red planet as a home for a human colony is a real thing. And you know it's real when the investors get involved.
Really, there's going to be an explosion of entrepreneurial opportunity because Mars will need everything from iron foundries to pizza joints. I think Mars should really have great bars, the Mars Bar.
Mars needs pizza and corny jokes, apparently, from SpaceX founder Elon Musk, speaking this year about big plans to colonize Mars. Well, if it happens, Elon Musk will benefit from the knowledge gained from NASA's InSight lander, scheduled to launch this Saturday from Southern California and land on Mars next November. Farah Alibay is a payload systems engineer for NASA's InSight mission. She joins me now from the very Air Force Base in California where InSight is launching tomorrow. Farah, thanks for being here.
Yeah, no problem.
How are things looking?
We're very excited. Everything's going well so far. And so we just have to hope that the weather is with us tonight. And hopefully we'll be on our way to Mars.
Great. Well, everyone will be watching. Look, Farah, InSight is a lander. It's not a rover. And everybody got really excited about Curiosity and Opportunity and what they could do on the surface of Mars. Why does NASA want to sit in one place this time with InSight and not scoot around the surface of Mars?
Because the measurement that we're making is fundamentally different. We're studying the interior of Mars, and so we're using a seismometer and a probe to do that. So in fact, what we want from our lander is to be as quiet as possible. If we were moving around the planet, all the noise that would be coming from that rover would just be causing noise into our instruments. So our goal is to be as quiet as possible so that we can listen to the heartbeat of Mars.
A seismometer on board, which you helped install, of course, as a payload specialist. What does that mean? Listening for Mars quakes?
Yes, essentially. Mars doesn't have tectonic plates the way that the Earth does, but there is still seismic activity from lava below the surface. Mars has one of the biggest, well, has the biggest volcano in the solar system, so we know there's activity below there. And we'll also be able to hear micrometeorite impacts. When they hit the planet, they also cause seismic activity that we can detect. And by looking at those waves and their characteristics, that gives us an understanding of what the interior looks like, how big the core is, what it might be made of, and how big the crust is, for example.
Now, we're starting to turn our attention and our imagination to human colonies on Mars, and not in such a fantastical way like we did a couple of decades ago. Far as I mentioned, this is starting to get real. So what does knowing about that seismic activity mean for eventual human colonization? What do you need to know?
Well, so what we're really looking at is how the planet was formed and how it evolved. So understanding what transition Mars might have gone through might give us an idea of, for example, what happened to its atmosphere and its magnetosphere. Those are things that we think Mars had and no longer have. But really here, Mars is an extra data point in our understanding of rocky planets in general. So the readings that InSight will give us not only have implications for us understanding the mechanisms that guide Mars and its evolution, but also how other planets and even potentially exoplanets, which are planets around other solar systems, around other stars, how they might have evolved and what their properties might be. If we can derive certain rules about how planets behave, we might be able to better understand Earth-like planets around other stars, for example.
So purely scientific intentions from NASA, which is absolutely fantastic. It's exciting. Farah Alibay, we're all going to be watching tomorrow as InSight takes off from Southern California on its way to Mars. Congratulations. Thank you for all the work you do, Farah Alibay.
Thank you.
InSight headed to Mars tomorrow. Thanks for being with us this hour on The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. The Victoria and Albert Museum in London is one of the world's premier showcases of decorative arts and design. It has a permanent collection of over 2 million items. But a new exhibit of Ethiopian artifacts has reopened a familiar debate in the UK. Should Britain hold on to artifacts seized from other countries at the height of the British Empire? In this case, artifacts taken 150 years ago after a confrontation with the Emperor of Ethiopia.
When we speak about whether a country is capable of maintaining its own artifacts and historical objects, I think the fundamental question is, who owns it? Whose is it? Whose is it to decide what should be done? I think every question should begin there.
That's Mazamin Giste. She's a Fulbright scholar, essayist, and author of the novel Beneath the Lion's Gaze. When we spoke about this exhibit at the Victoria and Albert Museum, she explained the history behind this collection and why it's become the source of so much resentment between Ethiopia and the UK.
We're talking about religious manuscripts, ecclesiastical texts. We are talking about a dress that was worn by the Empress Turunesh. We are talking about both personal, deeply intimate objects, clothing, jewelry, rings, as well as religious objects. I think for most of the West, this is a little known incident, but to Ethiopia, this was a devastating loss.
Now, let's go back for just a moment. Would you give us a little bit of history and tell us about the Magdala expedition and the confrontation that took place in 1868?
Yes. In 1868, the Napier expedition under General Robert Napier came in ostensibly to rescue about 36 hostages that were held by Theodros. But they went in with 13,000 soldiers, 8,000 auxiliary workers, thousands of pack animals. They created a railway from the sea up into Magdala, so they knew that they were going to be taking items, and they also brought with them Robert Holmes, who was a manuscripts curator from the British Museum.
Well, what happened when this massive expedition arrived in Magdala and confronted the emperor?
The emperor released the hostages, and rather than surrender to the British, he committed suicide. The British took his son, Alamayu, who was, I think, around 6 years old, maybe 7 years old at the time, And they took Alemayu, put him on a ship. Ironically, he was put on a ship along with the looted goods, and everything sailed to England. Alemayu stayed in England until his death at 18 years old, and his remains are still in England, which is another point of contention. Ethiopia has repeatedly requested that his bones be brought back.
Why was he along on that trip? Why was he with all of those pilfered items?
I say he was taken against his will. I know that at some point in England, he wanted to come back and he was not allowed. There were relatives who wrote letters to him and he'd never received those letters. His life was unhappy in England. So whether he went willingly, a six-year-old boy, whether he went willingly or not, he did want to return at some point. There are people who contend that he was on this ship as a way to save him from rivals of his father, that it was not safe. And I think that this is another instance where this history has been learned and written by those same people who took.
And in fact, trying to decide whether a six-year-old can consent is a separate question.
Absolutely.
That probably answers itself. But part of this history extends to today, because to this day, the prince's remains are in Windsor Castle, the residence of the queen. And formal requests have been made from the government of Ethiopia as recently as 2007
yes.
to get those remains back. What has the queen or the government of the United Kingdom said?
They've ignored the requests. There's been no movement on this. And, you know, of everything, of all the items that were taken, of everything that was put on that ship, the remains of Prince Alemayu touches a very strong chord with Ethiopia. This was in many ways a kind of forced migration, and it's time to return him back to his home.
Maza, there's a counter argument, and I know you've heard it. Maybe it doesn't apply to the remains of Prince Alemayu, but to the artifacts that are in the Victoria Albert Museum and other places. And that argument is they're just safer in England than they would be in Ethiopia. They're guarded, they're under curators. What do you say to that argument for these artifacts remaining in England?
I think that argument is condescending. I think it's racist. I think it's patronizing. And I think it comes from a deep ignorance about Ethiopia's capabilities, about the capabilities of countries that are not Western to take care of their own items. For a number of years, Ethiopia has kept safely, securely, well-preserved the bones of Lucy, one of the earliest hominids, the bones that helped the world understand the origins of mankind, of humans. The country, the scientists, the curators, the archaeologists are quite capable of this. This is old rhetoric, but unfortunately, this is rhetoric that still seems to stand.
You know, Maza, it's easy to imagine you and I having this conversation 75 years ago and sort of being laughed out of the room because the colonial era was still alive and well for the UK, right? The UK's colonial era is over, and it's hard to imagine, I have to say, a good argument today for not returning these items.
I completely agree with you on that. I think that from the perspective of the V&A Museum, these items add an intrinsic value to the museum. It adds what they call, and I quote, a cosmopolitanism. I find that, again, the question for me becomes, who owns this? The V&A Museum has said that because these items are valuable to them and they understand the complicated history behind them, they are willing to loan on a long-term basis these items to Ethiopia. That is not an appropriate response. It's not an appropriate solution. Who has the right to lend, to borrow, to claim, to own? Ethiopia should not borrow its own items.
You know, Maza, I was in London recently for a brief spell. I went to the Tower of London, and I got the chance to see the crown jewels. Beautiful, priceless, gorgeous crowns and diamonds and scepters. I wonder if the queen would be willing to have them housed in Addis Ababa for the next 200 years.
Mm-hmm. And imagine if those crown jewels were stolen by any other country, and then that country, 100 years later, said, well, we'll let you borrow it for a certain amount of time.
Maza Mengistay is a Fulbright scholar, essayist, and author of the novel Beneath the Lion's Gaze. She's been writing about the Makdala items in the Victoria and Albert Museum. Maza, thank you.
Thank you.
Here's some money. Go see a Star Wars.
Adventure? Excitement? Jedi craves not these things.
The Force is with us, but that's about it.
Dude, she's Vader.
No! She's the emperor.
Jar Jar Binks makes the Ewoks look like shafts.
So it's on our training schedule for today. Lightsabers?
And they gon' bust up Vader's hood, the Death Star. Now what do you call that?
Intergalactic Civil War?
Gentrification!
This one is mine.
If anybody's anybody, I'm Han.
And you're Chewbacca.
Chewie?
The Force is strong in that one.
Luke, I am your father.
May the 4th be with you. It is Star Wars Day. Hey, there's no Star Wars movie out right now, but it is May the 4th. That's Star Wars Day. Rafer Guzman is here with me, film critic for Newsday and for us here at The Takeaway. Hey, Rafer.
Hello, Todd.
May the 4th be with you, Rafer.
And as well.
Thank you. I see you waving your hand as you do that to your mind trick on me. All right, see if you can use your mind trick here, Rafer. I've got some Star Wars trivia for May the 4th. This one's audio. Just take a listen to this. Listen closely. That cast of creatures there, Rafer, from the Star Wars universe. Did you catch it?
I caught that.
Well, all right, now your job here, we're going to go through a couple of these. Your job is to listen to a creature from the Star Wars universe, and after each one, tell me who you're listening to. Are you ready?
Okay.
You got to ID them. Here we go. Vince, hit number one. Who's that, Rafer?
Oh, boy, I don't know. Those the chess pieces?
Those are sand people. Who will soon be back and in greater numbers. All right, you didn't get that one. Number two, Vince?
I've got a bad feeling about this, Todd.
Rafer.
I'm stumped.
Think about suction cups clinging to the exterior of the Millennium Falcon.
Oh, I still can't name that.
Those are Minox.
Come on, how would I get Minox?
They're chewing on the power cables again. Will you get them if you're a fan? All right, you'll get number three. This one you'll get. Go ahead, Vince. What's that grunt, Rafer?
Todd, I'm out. I'm out. I'm completely stumped, as
you're
usual.
You're on Hoth on a Tauntaun, my friend.
Is that
friend.
A Tauntaun? Okay. Well, at least I knew what a Tauntaun was.
All right, I'll give it to you if you get the bonus.
Are you in costume right now, Todd?
Here's the bonus. Who's that little guy?
Is that at least an Ewok?
That's not an Ewok. He might be a cousin. That's...
Boy.
That's Salacious Crumb on the lap of Jabba the Hutt, Return of the Jedi.
I'm going to call you Salacious Crumb from now on, Todd.
0-4. Rafer, I mean it. May the 4th be with you. I think you need it.
Thank you. Thank you, Todd.
Let's get to today's real movies. There's no Star Wars out today, but let's go to our first movie for your reviews, Rafer. You've got Tully. This is a thriller. We've got Charlize Theron, who's always a box office draw. Let's hear a clip.
It's like a Lifetime movie where the nanny tries to kill the family and the mom survives and she has to walk with a cane at the end.
Get over yourself.
A thriller, a horror movie from Charlize Theron and director Jason Reitman, Rafer?
You might think so because of the premise that Charlize plays Marlo. She's an exhausted mother of three who decides to hire a night nanny for help. And, you know, you might be thinking sort of Hand That Rocks the Cradle here, some kind of a bad babysitter scenario. It's really not that. And I have to say, I was very skeptical going into this film what the story was going to be here. Was this going to be sort of a modern-day Mary Poppins tale? Was it going to be a heartwarmer, a drama, a comedy? I don't want to say too much, but I will say this movie really pulled me in. It really pulled me into this experience of motherhood, what it's like to be in that sort of that dark tunnel of sleepless nights, which I know somewhat as a dad, not quite as well as mothers do. But I remember that from when my children were born. And this kind of surreal kind of experience that you enter. Tully, played by Mackenzie Davis, comes in, sort of saves the day, bakes cupcakes. She's this fount of energy and kind of rescues Marlo. There is a reveal to this film that I don't want to spoil that won't satisfy everybody, but I think some people, as I did, will find it quite moving. It's a sort of a dark film, kind of an early dark Mother's Day present, if you will. I loved this movie. I thought it was really interesting. I'm not sure if everyone will cotton to it the way that I did, but I thought it was a really great film.
All right, Rafer, well, let's take a minute before we go here because The Karate Kid is back on YouTube Red with Cobra Kai. Listen to this.
So am I going to get the karate pajamas too?
Quiet!
The student only speaks when spoken to. Is that understood?
Yes. Yes, sir.
You'll always address me as sensei. Is that understood?
Yes, sensei.
These aren't pajamas. This is a gi, and you'll get one when you've earned it. All right, you ready to begin your training?
Yes, sensei.
What the?
Oh,
lesson one. Strike first. Never wait for the enemy to attack.
You could give me like a warning.
Quiet!
Johnny Lawrence from Cobra Kai is back with Daniel LaRusso, Rafer.
Yeah, who thought we'd see Johnny Lawrence again? William Zabka, you know, the blonde bully from The Karate Kid. And here he is, the hero of this streaming series, Cobra Kai. I thought this was really interesting. It's kind of interesting to see Ralph Macchio back on screen as The Karate Kid. But he's not really the hero. He's almost kind of the villain in this case. Really interesting flip-flop. I really enjoyed this series. I will say the production value is a little low. The acting could be better, I guess. Mm. But the writing is great. It's a lot of fun. And who doesn't want to see these two guys back at the All-Valley Karate Championship again? You know, 34 years later, it's a lot of fun.
A little older, a little slower. Not like you, Rafer. Rafer, thanks so much.
Thanks, Todd.
Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday and for us here at The Takeaway. Oh man, that's an old one. God, from years ago. You know, today's my last day with you here on The Takeaway. It was just over 10 years ago. I got on the air to talk about Capitol Hill with some radio hosts I barely knew. And today I've got Rafer here with me doing Star Wars creature trivia. So we've come a long way. But between then and now, I got to report on stories from all over Washington and all over America. The election of Barack Obama, the inauguration of Barack Obama. Man, it was cold that day. Coal miners in Kentucky, the fall of John Boehner, and the rise of Donald Trump, which, yes, I got very, very wrong. Politics has changed in the time we've been together here on The Takeaway. Every day you're told that journalists are the enemy, that they're fake. It's a nihilistic and a cynical time. There's a lot of bad faith out there, and I think it's going to get worse. But here on the show, I think we have an alternative. You know, joining you here every day here as host, I met America's authors and journalists and thinkers, activists, and just regular people with a story to tell. And we've had to deal with our own scandal, too, here at The Takeaway. Turn the lens on ourselves. No nihilism. Hopefully, just honest conversation. It's an exciting time because Tanzina Vega is here on Monday, and I know for a fact how excited she is to start the conversation all over again with you. And that conversation is made by the most creative crew in public radio. The control room is Ethan Oberman, Vince Fairchild, Isabel Angel, and director Jay Cowett, who has done more for me than I have time here to tell you about. The producers are Jeremy House, Daniel Roberson, Oliver Lazarus, Alexandra Boti, Liz Ross, Rob Gunther, Asher Stockler, and my fellow Road Warrior, Amber Hall. David Gable keeps everything together. Our intern is Charlene Robinson. The senior producer is Ellen Frankman. Executive producer is Irva Gunja. And I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.